Hello and welcome to our show. You are listening to the Uberly to Hackerforce Radio. My name is Sigflup. We have a number of things this week. I have an announcement to make. It turns out that DeepGeek is interested in hosting our website, which makes DeepGeek member number two of the Uberly to Hackerforce. Now, part of my goal with this was to, well, you remember how you used to see, like, all these hacker clans and hacker groups in the mid-90s to maybe late 90s? The Legion of Doom, the Masters of Deception, Loft to a lesser extent, and, well, probably to a greater extent, and all these people, it seems the only thing that's left is the Cult of the Dead Cow. So, we need another group. And the Uberly to Hackerforce will be it. If you want to join our ranks, you certainly may. If you have anything to contribute whatsoever, as far as technological things are concerned. But before we begin with the rest of the releases and whatnot, I do have a bit of a poem. I haven't listened to the actual radio in a while. You know, the one with the antenna? Quick tour of the FM dial. All this pop music is absolute crap. 50,000 watts of Lady Gaga shoved in the atmosphere and people rapping about how the yellow brick road is paved with $100 bills. I'm just happy this doesn't come through my dental work. The radio goes to shit. The television tells us how we're all gonna be idols and movie stars, selling that American dream like a fucking carrot on a stick. You're telling me that this is not gonna happen in the internet. You're telling me that the internet's special. You're telling me that we've learned our lesson. The people who take the internet from us are going to play us like a fiddle, just like they always have. Obama enforces trade embargo against open source. What the fuck is that? Encryption as munition and YouTube deleting all your videos. DMCA, the DM fucking CA. Comcast blocking your torrents, making sure the rich get paid first. Hackett stifled because they're not from CNN. Your books being snatched from your Kindle. It's Fahrenheit 451. People in the States being afraid to break all this primitive encryption and restriction mechanisms. Dmitry Skrylov being held in jail for trying to free the ebook. Copyright extension because of a goddamn cartoon mouse. You're telling me the internet is not going to be taken. Alright, so that's my poem. We are going to be releasing a couple of things, kind of a couple of older things. The first thing is called Mega Happy Sprite, which is a sprite editor for the Sega Genesis. This can edit VRAM dumps directly if you want it to. And that includes VSRAM dumps and CRAM dumps as well. Now, if you want to download this, the URL to download it is https://hobonesdot.net/mega/mega_distrib. That's hobonesdot.dogsoft.net/mega/mega_distrib. .tgz. This is a graphical editor, of course. It's a sprite editor. Why wouldn't it be graphical? But you can edit the scroll planes as you would a frame buffer, which is kind of nice. You can draw lines directly onto your screen space, and it will fill the patterns automatically. And comes with a number of art samples. Actually, it comes with one sample. If you want art samples, I'll give you art samples. It comes with a dump from Sonic the Hedgehog. That's in a file called example.mega. Now, if you open example.mega in a text editor, it's text, pretty much. The different binary RAM sections for the graphics chip in the Sega Genesis are represented by UUN codes in the mega file. All the other configuration, where scroll A begins, where scroll B begins, is in text. And it's you can change it pretty easily. So I hope this sprite editor works out for you. I haven't really released it anywhere else, sort of, but did a presentation about it, but I haven't really released it I've gotten a lot of use from it myself, so it's pretty useful. Now, the other program that we're going to release is called PITS, which stands for PITS is the Sucks. and this one is of questionable usage, although I have sort of gotten to use it a little bit. It's a patch editor for patches for the YM2612 sound chip. Now, I have a little keyboard on the bottom, and you can hit keys, and you can change the octave, and you can change the low-frequency oscillator, and all sorts of different things regarding every operator of your FM channel, and you can change the algorithm, and there's a button on the right called Luck. You push that, and it fills everything randomly, and you usually get a better sound. Then you can configure yourself. And this one also reads YM2612 dumps, as well as writes them. So for these two, if you have an emulator and you dump out these memories, you can edit them directly. So the third thing that we're going to do, and this is going to encompass the remainder of the program, is we're going to play this song. We'll be right back. And this song has significance. It's not just a random song. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Now, that was a 2 kilobyte synthesizer that runs on OpenBSD. Now, I just realized that I didn't give you the URL for PITS, so let me give you where you can download that. The address is https://hobonest.dogsoft.net/pits_DISTRIB.tgz. That's hobonest.dogsoft.net/pits_distrib. Now all of these temporarily before we get on Deep Geek's computers. Temporarily, we have a website at uberlite.atari.org. That's uberlite with no space .atari.org. And there are links to all the releases we've had so far, as well as what we're going to do for the rest of the program. Now, the song that I just played, this synth, I held a panel actually a couple of days ago. Regarding its construction, and in general, putting together small programs. The sound is, I'm a little bit quiet in this presentation, I recorded it, hopefully you can make me out. Now, if you want to see this presentation, because it does have some slides, and it helps if you see it, you can see it at hobonest.dogsoft.net/bump.avi, and there'll be a link on the uberlite.atari.org main site for that, or temporary site for that. And a note of trivia before I gave this presentation I came all prepared. I brought my own amplifier because I was worried about the place not having a PA system. And then I typed, because I'm a complete git, right? I typed rm-rf slash, or actually dot slash in my redirectory as a root, and deleted everything on my computer moments before the presentation. I've been using Unix now for 10 years, and this has been a problem only recently, and I figured out why. It's because I can't talk and type at the same time. Like, when I'm alone and no one's talking to me, I can multitask like a multitasking Melphobian, if that makes sense. Or when the banging techno music is in my ears. But, you know, the second someone says, hi, Sigflub, I start typing rm/rf like there's no tomorrow. Just, I don't know, I can't really type while I talk. So I really have to be careful if I'm root. I was mounting and unmounting stuff, so that's the reason why it's root. If I'm root, not to, to be careful if I'm talking to someone about typing. So, but it was fun. It was a community, it was a TC log, right? So it was a bunch of Unix geeks. And so we kind of made a challenge out of recovering everything, or recovering at least the presentation material before doing a fresh install of BSD. So that's the story about the presentation. But I hope you can make it out. I hope you can understand what I'm saying, because I'm awfully quiet. I try to level a little bit, but I'm awfully quiet. So this is regarding the song that you just heard. So we won't be back after that. Take care. So enjoy the presentation. Bye-bye.
What I'm going to be talking about is size-restricted programming. This is what this means is programming applications, just programs that are entirely contained within one binary. And the binary is below 64K or below 4K or something like that. There's a theme called the demo theme. And I was going to show you a demo, unfortunately that's gone now, but there is a theme called the demo theme, where it's kind of an art to make programs that have some sort of audio or visual presentation within these constraints. And so to begin with, if I can have everyone sign this, I'm going to pass it around. If you want to sign my disk back, they certainly may. And don't be afraid to open it up if there's not enough room. Put your name on it anywhere, it doesn't matter.
Why would we want to do that?
Because it's fun. I'm not going to explain fun. But so let's play a game. Game is called the size of the
binary.
And what we're going to do is give me a Unix command.
What's the first name, right?
Anything. Okay. Really anything to be a smiley. But LS. How big do you think LS is?
Lots of options.
Lots of options. What's a smaller program?
Cat.
All right. How big do you think cat is? Anyone?
Oh, no. It's bigger than that. Probably a couple of meg.
Couple of meg?
Two meg?
Two more guesses.
100K.
That's
not the first
thing. All right.
So
yeah. It is 99K. Holy shit.
Wow.
That's right. Yeah, that's pretty impressive. One more. Give me a smaller instrument. Yeah. Very small is out there.
No.
Press the bill from the DVD. Press DW. Oh, yeah.
Working directly.
You said 100K.
No.
I don't think that is shell code.
It's a shell.
Is that shell code?
There you go.
I can't imagine not.
I would think so.
No, it's not shell code.
Boy, I'm going to mess out of that one, isn't I? Well, I think it's error.
You get it.
I downloaded it. Open office and it was a...
4K? It is 99K. Oh, no, that's cat.
Is it wow?
No, it is E.
The
song is about Jesus.
We'll say thank you.
Thank you. I'll open up another window here while I go.
How big is the synthesizer?
That is the synthesizer.
Oh, the synthesizer sound, plus the sound?
Everything. Okay. Well, I'll show you how it's back out. This is the code of it. I won't get into it too much. Basically, we fly sounds, we run lump, that's the main synthesizer, we write that up to audio. This bit of code is a bit of ANSI, but to draw the let there be music. And so that is for 1.4K worth of source, so that's not too bad. And then this is the main synthesizer. We have structures for envelope, an envelope generator. Let me just stick to the main loop here. So this is amazing. Hit a lump. For every sample, we go through this. We have the lump sound is a couple of oscillators, buzz wave oscillators, added together with the frequency modulating and whatnot. There are other things. This is a low cutoff filter, a high cutoff filter. And everything gets multiplied, all the oscillators get multiplied by envelope. The envelope is run by a sequencer, which is in here, of course. The sequencer hacks off bits from the song data. And the song data is here. So we have a bitmap of the drum code and of the drum sequence and whatnot. So it's fairly small. And I'm just going to compile this one straight off. Not do our trick here as well.
Okay.
ignore the air code. This is a... So this is a code alone with no script. We compile it and it comes out to be 12K. And that is the 2K, but we have 12K apparently full of extra crap. So there's one trick that we can do, and that is to, without modifying the how the file is actually made, we can we can compress the file. We can tack on a little line at the beginning, which is actually a shell script to tail out the remainder of the file, which is compressed, and then unzip it and run what you just said compressed. It's a trick, but it's completely valid. I would completely shell archive. So that saves us a little bit of space, though. With the shell archive, we have 3K, 3.8K. So we're still missing a bit. Let's see what all this extra code stuff is about. So. Hello World. How big do you think Hello World is going to be? But this is, pardon? Under a page? PC log? Hello PC log? Information? So instead of Hello World, it's missing. When you say under 50K.
I haven't seen anyone use VI in about 15 years.
Well, we just did a fresh install, mate. Like,
I use it all the time, too.
What's that?
VI.
Ben, get with it.
So, Ben. You said it was going to be
6K? Or get back to
it. Oh, actually
not 6K. Well,
it's
still a 6K.
I
mean, why
is it 6K? We have
6K. That's what
we have.
Really?
Through the library,
there are
LinkedIn
back. No, I use it. It's a picture. 66 pages.
But we have some pretty staff on stuff. If you get rid of that, that'll get us a bit of a code.
Yeah.
Stack Hamburger, there's an optimization option not to do that, but still, quite a bit. So, how are programs compiled? And this is probably rudimentary for a lot of you, but we have X-Load.
I've been using text editors. Over the years since graduating undergraduate school, I've moved away from Unix, but the last few years I've been using Linux, but with a GUI.
Okay, and so an editor, that's kind of a system. This is an oversimplified version. We have some source code, to go through a compiler, a linker, a preprocessor, a compiler, an AP, and linker, the new linker, and I have some object code. Before we go to the linker, I have some object code. That goes through a linker. We always pretty much get included some static libraries. Libc is always static. There's also a library that's pretty much always there, libgcc, for architectures that can't do like 32-bit divides and things like that. So then I have a program binary. And while the program runs, we of course have all of this. We have a runtime linker that's encapsulated in the program. We have symbol names and all sorts of information to tell the runtime linker how to put the program together. And we of course have an interface with the kernel. So given all that, let's go back to our example. And we can type gcc/verbose. To see all the stages of the compiling. This is the compile stage, the preprocessor stage, the compile stage. This is the list assembly stage. Here's where it's linking. It's linking with collect2. You've probably seen from your messages using collect2. But we have a whole lot of crap here. We have some linker arguments. Dynamic linker, we have a path to dynamic linker. We have the linking with this library, CRT0, CRTBegin, CRTEnd, and all sorts of other things. Let me disassemble our program, which again is fairly big. How do you spell that wrong? Let's see if I spelled it. Yeah. Yeah, I would switch that around. So we have a lot of code there. If we can put out to the bottom.
This is the hello world?
This is the hello world. Mm-hmm. This is the actual code that we looked at before, where we call printf and also call the stack protector, and this is the actual code that we wrote. And a lot of other code gets stacked onto it. We have the PLD, PLT. This is used as a jump reference for dynamic libraries.
What did you use this for? What did you put on here?
The binary for
the link.
Yes, the dynamic link binary. This is still dynamic link. We don't have a static binary here, and it still has all this other crap. This is the entry, one of the entry points. This entry point calls constructors, well, ends up calling this entry point, and then this entry point is responsible for building up some of the constructors and deconstructors for doing dynamic symbol lookup and whatnot. And it's a whole lot of crap. So what we can do is we can write a program without any libraries. And unfortunately, to do this, there aren't too many tools to do this sort of thing natively, so we can do it manually. The first thing we can do is we can try and get complete control of our binary. But before we do that, let's describe a little bit what an executable looks like. This is our program as it looks in memory. We have code, data, heap, stack, kernel. The heap is usually maintained by the kernel and gives the code pointers to memory, new memory that it has, or it's maintained by the malloc. The standard lib malloc. And then eventually that talks to the kernel and that grows the heap. But then we have stack that's used for procedures that have local variables. Those usually are stacks. We have the code that actually consists of the text of the program, what actually gets run. Now, if we take a look at our binary again with object dump, what encapsulates a binary unit is called an ELF, an executable format, is what it's called. And the idea is just an encapsulation of different sections, an encapsulation of your code section, an encapsulation of your data section, and so forth. So let's take a look at our binary real quick. And we see that there are a whole ton of sections. We have a hash section. That's the speed up, lookup. We have the init section, where we enter text section, jump table section, view only data, all sorts of stuff, all sorts of unnecessary stuff. Constructors, deconstructors, the jump pad, and CSS, which is zeros, that doesn't get allocated. But taking a look at our diagrams from before, these are what some of the sections are. In it, the jump table, text, finalizing is in code. Then for data, we have 3 second sections typically allotted for that. We have read-only data, data that gets initialized once but is modifiable. So if you have int in your global namespace, int x equals 12, x equals 12 will be your data. But you can also type comp in x equals 12, and that will be in read-only data. And then say you have a zero, that will be in this section, which is uninitialized, a reservoir of where zero data should be. Okay, now if you open up a binary, this is the very first thing we have at the beginning of the text of the binary. We're just looking at the raw file here. We have an ident calling it an elf, 7f elf, which is an integer size, which is going to be. We have 111, which usually is in the ident, but it's actually the processor specification and the end unit specification. But that's usually 111. We have different things, file versions. We have an entry point where we're going to actually begin. We have the program header table offset and a segment table offset. You can think of this is part of the program header, this is part of the segment header. We actually have two tables used to represent how programs are loaded up into memory. One of them, the program headers, contains information like where in memory will this be, and then the section is a sub for the sections of the program section. So we don't have where in memory this will be, that's calculated from the program section. So do you really need these sections? And it turns out we don't. That's a lot of space that we can save if we just forget the fact that we forget needing those sections. So program header offset, we're probably going to have that always be there. Section header offset, we can put that to zero. We're not going to have a section header offset. The processor specific flag is usually ignored, so maybe we can put some code there, because only the long, but then we have the header size, program header entry size, number of entries. We only are going to have one. We're going to make a program with one segment, just a code segment, and we're going to make that readable, writable, and executable. We're not going to deal with other sections, because that's the minimal amount of data that we need. So we can forget the rest. These will be used for section strings, that's used for the relocation names, as well as the section names. So how are we going to do this? Well, we first of all need to get complete control of our environment. So what we could do is write a program like this. Text segment, that's the code segment, it's also known as text. At zero, have an acid strain. I like gummy bears. I very much like gummy bears. So, how can we alphabet to a file just as that? Well, it turns out the linker follows a linker script. This is a language that is sort of built into the linker, the new linker, and it tells the linker how to put together different sections. And this is what a typical, the default linker script looks like. No wonder our programs are so big. So what we can do is we can replace that with our own linker script. That's much, much simpler. Our outputting is a binary, it's going to be a 386. Our entry point is going to be the beginning. We put a symbol there, outside of the beginning. And then we're going to output the text segment. And that's it. We're going to output that beginning at zero. So how you want to compile this is you can compile it with the T argument, specify your linker script, and then have another argument, no standard library. We're not going to link to anything. No standard lib. We're not going to link to anything. So that's smaller. That's 20 bytes. That's probably our string. So we just successfully compiled an assembler program to a string that says that you like gummy bears. So now we can do whatever we want. We can manually write an outputter and output that. So this is what our outputter looks like. We have our beginning, 16 bytes in total. That's pretty much all that remains the same. In the executable, same machine, version 1. Our entry point is start frog. We have start frog way at the bottom there. Number of program entries, we only have one. And then we have the format of the program entry. This is a loadable, offset 0 in the file. This is our virtual memory address. You can have that anywhere. This is the default for OpenBSD. You can have it almost anywhere. I think the boundary is 2 gigabytes or something. You can pretty much have the program anywhere in memory. I'm going to be clogging the kernel. Then we have the size. And you can forget this for now, 64K. That's now the preparation of my end. But the size that we're going to load is file n. We have file n symbol at the bottom. And we're going to subtract that from outn, which is 0. But it might not be 0. You kind of have to watch out. I mean, you can put orb 0 there, but it's still going to be loaded into memory at your entry point. So to keep things, you want to keep things relative because that may be different. Unless you put orb 0, but that might stress how your binary is drawn. It's going to be readable, writable, and executable. So we can put all of the code there, and it's going to be page aligned. We align by pages, 4K pages. Now this is our program. We have no library that we can't call standard loops, we can't call anything. So we have to do direct system calls. This is system call number 1, which is exit, pretty much. And we call system calls with an interrupt. That way the processor goes into supervisor mode and goes into the kernel space whenever we call the system call. Aside from the interrupt, it's pretty much like calling any of the procedure. You push things on stack and you call it. So that's a program, and we can compile this. And we can run it. And it doesn't crash. It's valid. It just exits. But so that's good. We have a very small program now. It has 92 bytes worth of exiting programs. But it's funny because there's actually 2 Unix programs called True and False. And they do the same thing. And they are probably bigger. Ah, it's a big cover. I think they got it a bit smaller.
79.
Well, how can you get it a bit smaller? I'm not exactly sure what they did. This is the first time I actually looked at the size of this around, but this is ignored by your software. They get the code in there. You don't have to load a code from the end of your author, or you can load it from anywhere. So it's a very useful format. If this is, well, that's the only one I know right now that for sure that's ignored. There are other things that are ignored too, so there's some room there. So, let's make a program that has C in it instead of just assembly. We have our ALF header again. We have written an assembler function. It's called sys, which is just a replacement of syscall. You have the first argument being system call. This pops that off the stack. We may keep everything else in stack, calls the interrupt, and returns whatever code you're going to have. Should be another property then, but whatever. So that's our function. We look at main. Now we're doing this. We have system call number 4, which is write. System call number 1, which is edit. System call number 4, write hello world. And that happens to be 15 bytes long, and then end it. Hello world. So that's cool. The only difference here in the ALF header is in the entry point you can specify a main. You don't have to do any sort of constructions or anything like that to run main. Your stack is set up. Everything is done to run. Your program is loaded. The only thing that's really used for is dynamic libraries, but we don't care about that so much. So that's not too bad. 158 bytes. It's a little bit bigger. So we go back to our original code. And we can take a look at it. Now we're doing a lot of things here. Not so much of a lot of things. We're opening up a file, opening up dev audio. That can be done with the system call. We have the format structure that we're doing passing to IOPTL. We have a macro that builds that for us. This macro actually calls memset. That's the only library that this macro calls. So if we replace memset, we don't need that library. Then we have an IOPTL. We write a lock right in here. That's it. We print stuff out, and we're really not doing much else. So we can pretty much replace all these things with syscalls. I just write open IOPTL. And we're replacing open, for instance, with our just function. And it should just work. The problem is we're also calling the math library as well. As you can see, we have written math set, so we're replacing math. And the only other thing that we're doing is we are calling find, so we can replace that, push the argument on the stack to a floating point find, pull up the stack into ret and return ret, and that replaces our find. If you look at the disassembly, it's fine. A lot more code than that, albeit this is equivalent. It's kind of strange. And the rest of the code really doesn't call anything. And And then at the very last bit, we compress it. We stick our uncompressed header onto it, make a shell script. We have our program, which is 2.3K, so that's not bad. And it runs. So that's cool. We compressed a program that was 16K to 2K. And perhaps this is a little short, but I believe I'm done with my presentation. Do you have any questions?
You find yourself scooping out all kinds of unnecessary code out of other applications?
Out of other applications? Yeah, there's some demos, programs that have their code. I was going to show you a couple of demos, and I figured that would take the time. But we're fortunate in Linux because we can do that. We're fortunate in Unix because we can do that. We're fortunate because we have a relatively easy syscall. We can make syscalls relatively easily. Now, Windows being proprietary, maybe they have as an efficient way of making syscalls, but no one does. And I suspect no one, if the interface changes through versions, I'm sure it's like, I've never seen anyone make syscalls with Unix. Do they have a, yeah?
Can I get a hold of the code?
Yeah, sure. I can put on the drive there for you. Any other questions, Dad? This is our section header. We have a name index in the next two sections, but we have another section that is devoted to strings. And then we have an index into that section for strings. So we don't have to put out, we can have a fixed, this happens to be a long, fixed size reference string that way. We have a type. Is it executable? Is it page loaded? We can specify whether things are page loaded or not, which is very strange. An address, this is the address relative to what program header this is in. File offset again, and a size, which is very nice. You can put anything anywhere in the file you want. It's a very simple file format. Edit alignment, add info. This is not used for anything, info. The specification says info. I believe that's 16 bytes, which possibly means itself. And also entry size. We can have a different size of a section versus the size that it is in memory. You can have a section with a zero size. That's the BFS section, which is just zeros. It's not in the file. We just fill memory with zeros. This is our program section. Again, pretty simple. We have memory alignment, the loadable section, and the loadable program section, the virtual address, the physical address. The reason why we separate the virtual address and physical address is if we're loading something from a ROM or cache, and we have the data segment in the beginning of the ROM, despite the fact that it is loaded somewhere off in memory. So you want to have the symbols match where it is in memory. Memory size, file size, again, those can be different. And memory alignment as well. So they're very similar sections. Do we have any other questions?
Cool. Question.
Yes.
If I wanted to start doing this stuff, where do I start to look to find out all this stuff about ELF files?
Demo scene. This is not too big in the States, but it's huge in Europe.
But demo scene is just like a bunch of demos. Is it articles on it, like how to do this stuff? Or?
There is actually a wiki, 4K, in 4K, dot, under Grund, UNDERGRUND.org. And that is a wiki how to do this in other operating systems as well as Linux. Does anyone want to run a 1K demo? Seriously, anyone have internet access? We'll download one and we'll stick it on here. Can we do this for you?
Go ahead.
You have a pretty good graphics card?
I have a great graphics card. I don't have RAM.
You have a great graphics card. Is that Linux?
No, but I have Linux on a virtual box.
Anyone have a graphics card with drivers? That's important. You want to come up?
Well, my Magic has great drivers. My Linux VM doesn't have acceleration, though.
We'll show
4K. I can do software with it.
The problem is it's a Pixel Shader 3 program.
Oh, yeah.
So, that's the only great graphics card right there. Just a note about graphics cards. Holy crap. Holy crap. You can do real-time ray tracing in a graphics card.
Since
like 4 years ago. It's a massive parallel computer. Since Pixel Shader 3 model came out, I think that was 2016. And you can have a program that can have different size for loops, jump from the fucking launch. It's a pretty general purpose program, albeit it has no communication with the agency. But every Pixel runs this program, and when it's done, they can do ray traversal for every Pixel.
Yeah, but is that... Will that work with a number of the spectral number of triangles? I mean, that's
it's
the
not triangles though, it's spheres and
pixels.
It's different geometry.
Well, I know, but I mean, the bottom line is, every geometric shape has motion of the triangle, with three open a corner. Isn't that the requirement?
If you're using rasterizer, the rasterizer graphics card, which is sort of the traditional sort of. Way to draw brackets where you have like a triangle in 3D space and you take the corners of it and you rotate it and translate it
so
and
they still do.
So we have a triangle, this is how the graphics card goes. We have a triangle, we rotate, translate, and
right. We put it in perspective, right.
And yeah, we do all the projection stuff,
right.
And you get like the triangle.
Right.
And the hardware, traditionally, what you do is you figure out the gradients of the size of the triangle and all kinds of stuff. Basically,
right.
You're doing a rasterization of it pixel by pixel.
Right.
And so what graphics cards do nowadays is, I'm not exactly sure how they separate the figuring out what pixels are. Basically, you have an array of processors, and they're all giving their own pixel within this triangle. And they're also giving data like, this is the offset, this is where you are relative to your 3 points.
Right. But I mean, I would think that writing the code necessary for, ray tracing.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't that be a little bit much to handle for if you did a high resolution? I mean,
I suppose. It's possible.
Like,
this is not theory. Like, what kind of graphics card do you have? Maybe we can show you.
From my understanding, ray tracing ignores the polygon model and just says, here's a pixel, follow it back.
You get a pixel. I mean, that's what the shade is. You get a pixel. But from that standpoint, yes, that would work. But the math involved with following it, for each pixel you'd have to follow the light back, and but if you involve reflections and other stuff like that, I would think that the number crunch would be too much to follow for the surface.
It turns out, this is actually kind of interesting, there is a new tool that is being used for graphics cards called Ray Motion. I'll explain ray tracing a little bit. Basically, what you said, you have a pixel, you have a camera, you have the camera's origin, you have every pixel being an array of vectors going out, intersecting the origin of the pixel. And then you take that and you find out the closest intersection to an object, typically these are objects where you can figure out mathematically the exact intersection,
right.
Vector sphere intersection, sort of thing. You're intersecting with a sphere. From that, maybe you take a vector from your intersection point to the center of the sphere,
right.
And that becomes the normal of it, and
right.
You bounce right off your normal,
right.
And it's reflected, and you continue.
Right, I mean, depending on how many light sources there are, you have to do a bunch of bouncing and how you start to shape
it. Think how reflective it is. How many reflective spheres do you see in the sphere?
None, but I'm just saying.
What about the technique?
Alright, well, go ahead,
because
I'm more interested in the
technique. Don't you ask the computer to render it?
You do ask the computer to render it, and this is how it does it. If you want to do ambient occlusion, for instance, and you have a ray intersecting a point, and you have a normal and bouncing off, and it bounces off in one location, that's not very ambient. You have to have a scatter for this.
Right.
A trick around this is radioptics, but that's an entirely different rendering technique.
Photon mapping.
Radioptics is rendering your image at the point where your ray intersects, and then that is sort of your theoretical scatter of rays.
Mm-hmm.
But with rays marching, you have an entirely different way of figuring out how you intersect an object. You can do it step by step, and you just say, am I in the object or am I out of the object? Am I in the object or am I out of the object? And so, once you find an intersection, you can object that way. You don't have to scatter rays, you can just have a volume around it, and say, am I in the object, am I out of the object, around the volume. And so instead of 1,024 rays that are coming off of it, you can have 4, am I in the object, out of the object. Sort of, you can do it that way. And it's moving from ray tracing to the problem of secondary rays, which is what you're saying, is it's a problem of secondary rays. Most of the actual drawings are in secondary rays, which is very problematic because a pixel can cast millions of rays.
Right. Well, today is a number of rays, you wouldn't see it.
Yeah. Unless you go backwards, but that's an entirely different problem.
Right.
But we've moved it closer to the primary rate.
Right.
So the more you move it closer to the primary rate, and I don't know, I suspect that drawing good pictures is closer to primary rate than we realize. You don't see any spheres that are reflective or anything like that in real life.
No, but it's cool to have.
Yeah, it's totally great. I'll show you a video of, since we might not have the best graphics card, so we'll show you a video of ray marking.
All right, cool.
Out of phase there. Okay, so if you want to know about demos, this is a good database. You can look up programs by their size. You can, what are all the 4K demos that have been put in parties for the last 10 years and whatnot. So, let's see here. I believe one is called Tinted Tinted. There's this fellow RGBA that IQ of a group called RGBA that recently came to state. He's living in San Francisco now, so he does a lot of pixel share blogging. I can show you a procedural bracket firstly. This is a 4K procedural graphic using pixel shaders.
I think there's a variety of programs on there.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. It's a really huge thing. It's not present. I mean, it's slightly present in the States, but we have a couple of things that it is. That's what I'm also indicating here. So this is a real-time ray tracer. This is traditional ray tracing as it was in the 80s. So this is a very much hopefully that we can watch a YouTube video of it. On the party, they ran this on a DTX 8800. This can be done in real time.
How big is
this? 4K.
Go.
Oh, sorry.
Go on.
I don't have
a box. But this is for Windows. There's an advantage for 4K for Windows because you can access the general. You can access the. This is in the Foxton. This is sampled off the general MIDI sound wave set, which you can do in Windows because that gets best with the operating system. So the sound is in that cover, but. This is real time. I suppose I could show you the code for this.
You have a activity for a small amount of code.
Yeah. Can I grade Windows?
Yes.
Wow, too late. Well, let's see if we can find the code for that.
What's French?
What? Yeah, it's French. It's an onomatopoeia. I think that's an onomatopoeia for the sound of trumpet. Yeah. There we go. So this is. My screen website. Oh, I'll show you another 4K. This is insane. Before I do that. This is a softness. I keep it not just a softness. A guy named Lender did. The mount the gun in the vertex shader. We have it's spinning around the side. Kind of blends a little bit. This is 4K. Keep that in mind. This entire thing sounds, everything is in 4K. So, play that.
Ah.
Everything has to be procedurally generated.
Hello? Hi. No, I'm... Oh.
Have
they
hours?
No, I'm at a meeting here.
Yeah, it's
not that popular. Bye. Bye. Your audio file is 2.2.
Yes.
Wow, all this function kitchen. Now it makes damn small Linux look like bloatware.
Yeah. I don't have the code for the one you just saw somewhere.
Is it for the English one, Brittany?
Actually, no. It's like in Germany, it's like in Finland. It's like in Britain, but France as well. It's in Canada. I think I'm going to immediately find the code. I think it's on another of those places. But let's just, I'll go back and I'll see if I can find an example of ring marking. Complex as you want. If you can write a formula and figure out what is written inside of it and out of it, you don't have to figure out
an
exact intersection. You can just do it straight.
You see the purple functions
seen there
It's a pretty cool language. The shader language.
They're shader compilers, and I'm not sure exactly how big
a
shader
is.
You can
use
a lot of vectors now, so you can do a lot of vector stuff using
the shapes we're looking at
somewhat like so again, this is real time. Like, it's a video, but this is real time. The requirement is that it be real time and be shown as a part of the computer for it to be able to do that. And that's the way to get on the I think the person who came up with the idea of having a volume and then figuring out whether you're inside or out of volume to make on the computer. That was that way. I think that's what we did.
I'm not sure how it is, like, when Calgary was studying some of these fourth-dimensional functions, and it looks like it's moved in a similar way. Of course, I've never seen an M, just so I can't be sure.
Okay,
this is
this is what's called a procedural graphic. This isn't a video, it's a 4 kilobyte program that draws a picture, which is a picture draws. And that definitely is way more. I'm looking for one particular one that I know a little bit more of. Do we have any other questions at all?
Hey. They'll go back to the horse and buggy days and talk about nonsense. Have you ever heard of the Mandelbrot set?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so in August 1986, Douglas Hofstadter wrote a pseudocode to draw the Mandelbrot set.
Yeah.
So I had a Commodore 64.
Yeah.
So I wrote it in BASIC.
Yeah.
And however fast it flew out the set, the rapidity that would flew out the set would assign a different number. You know how long it would take to do one little window? It would take 8 hours.
I imagine it did.
Yeah, take 8 hours. And when I see this in real time, and I'm thinking, oh my God.
It's really ridiculous, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Moore's law, that the number of what is the number of transistors that increases exponentially?
Double
variation. Double variation. The number is...
It works in the $1,000, yeah.
Unfortunately, so does the amount of power needed by the new map.
I've got the bar to say the amount of wasted transistors every 4 months.
So we really made some gains, and I'm lucky that I remember this horse and buggy stuff. It's like when my grandfather used to walk back and forth to work for 10 miles, I can go there now in a couple of minutes in my car.
Well, I think there's a
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, complex...
Yeah, it's on imaginary numbers, the complex plane.
Yeah, that
would take over eight hours, and then you'd go again and again, so I'd let it run for a week.
But it's okay. I see your perspective there. But I think that's still relatively cool, because it's a 64K, the size of the program to generate that
was very small. It was just a real small, because you only had 64K memory divided into four places, so there, where would you put it? Under the kernel or where it was, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, I'm stuck in time warp, so it's very difficult. But I thought that Mandelbrot set was really neat. Then I did something with PostScript, and it would draw a picture, and I had a Commodore Amiga, which was a whole lot faster.
Yeah.
And I watched the picture, would draw each piece, you know, and now with the giant, you put the enter key and come up, and it's there.
You have an Amiga?
Yeah. No, the Amiga key would take, you know, maybe 10 minutes to draw a picture. But now it's just instant.
But you might be appreciative of this programming on a Commodore 64. There is a Commodore 64. People still program on a Commodore 64.
Yeah, they just use BASIC.
Oh, no, they're actually
very good. Well, no, I use it. I mean, you can. There's a zillion languages, I think, isn't there? Yeah, I mean, you can use it all, but...
I remember, when I had a Commodore 64, I remember poking an assembler into it. Like, I had someone wrote the assembler.
Oh, peek and poke, yeah.
Peek and poke, yeah.
Well, he was going to say something.
Me? Well, I was just going to say, back in the days of the old Coco, the Tandy color computer, the Coco, the Rainbow Magazine used to have a contest to see how much you could write in one line of BASIC. I think you had like 128 bytes or something. Or was it 256 bytes? And you can write a program to solve a quadratic equation, and I think it's 128 bytes. That kind of thing.
It's cool for the older computers as far as programs are concerned. I mean, like for DOS, for instance, you have COMFOG. Oh, the COMFOG is just the program. There wasn't any programming or anything like that. It's just a straight program. You can write a one byte program with just three tons. You could still do it.
Yeah, you used to write print and hello world and print and it'd come up.
Yeah.
So what was the smallest program you wrote?
A functional program? I
remember having to unlearn the go-to habit from BASIC when learning C.
Oh, go-to, yeah.
That's supposed to be bad form. I don't know if I agree, but...
Yeah, I don't mind the go-to so much.
Go-to is gross out.
I did. I had to unlearn the habit of relying on go-to and go-sub. It was an obstacle to learning C.
Probably went to if then else, huh?
Yeah. I like it for C or air conditioning as well. I mean, the labels are within the function, so go to fail or something like that. And it's rare that you'd actually use that, but every once in a while. I think this one is application for go to.
You mean like Maury says, she thinks I got money, she has to go to the store. Until I run out of money, she don't tell me to go to the store anymore.
And growth is supposed to be bad form, at least. At least when I was studying Pascal, I used to just, you know, it was like the devil or something. Go to, go sub.
Well, I don't know allegiance to anything, so.
Well, it's bad when you're maintaining large projects. I mean, I can understand if you keep it within a function or something, but I mean, I've seen programmers use it like a broad function and do all sorts of crazy stuff with it. How are you supposed to maintain my code?
Because you have no idea where you came from.
Yeah, you have no idea where you came from, you have no idea where you're going or why you're going there. It totally destroys the point of naming your functions if you're
It sounds like that song, I don't know where I've been and don't know where I'm going or something like that.
Yeah.
This is on the Commodore 64.
Okay.
Two discs, 585B on the Commodore 64.
What did you write?
This is not me, this is another disc. It's long, so I'll just... Remember, everything is on the Commodore 64. I don't know if you remember, like, Adventure was ported to C a while ago from Fortran, I think.
Fortran, no. That was, I don't hear well.
Oh, Adventure was ported to C a while ago, I believe from Fortran.
Yeah.
And if you look at the code for Adventure, it's horrible. There's like a switch case go to. There's like case 12 go to. What?
Well, I guess you'd call it so convoluted. You can't figure it out, huh?
Yeah.
In Adventure, it was hard to figure out what your available commands were, or how to do something.
Yeah. It took a while. I gave up, to be honest with you. I didn't play it. That's not a good computer. I'm going to have to shut my computer off now.
Nothing out of that. Yeah, thank you. Very good.
We'll run a little late here. I'm sorry, a little late.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming. I think next month I'm going to talk about making DVDs in Linux.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know a lot of people ask. I finally figured out how to do it.
It's a program called Movie Flex.
If you're coming back next month, you're welcome to stay and watch the rest of this.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.